So, good afternoon. My talk today is entitled Universities in the Next Stage of Building Purely Market-Based Employee Ownership. The overriding question I want to explore today is, as employee ownership matures, what role should universities play in helping it reach its next stage of development? In many countries, employee ownership has grown significantly. We've seen more employees become owners. We've seen governments recognize the importance of employee ownership. We've seen successful examples across different industries. But after periods of growth, a familiar question often is asked, has employee ownership started going backwards? I do not believe this is the right question. These four slides, first, show the number of employee owners working at ESOPs and working cooperatives in the US since 1974, the year major employee ownership was first introduced in the US. It's interesting to note the ratio of employee owners working at ESOPs in the US compared to the number employed at worker cooperatives is 350 to 1. The number of employee owners at ESOPs is significantly above 10 million. While there is a plateauing of the number of employee owners at ESOPs, there's not a decrease. And as I show the amount of value in the employer's ESOP accounts, in the second slide, the graph shows rapid growth over time, leading to trillions of dollars of value for employee owners. There are fewer ESOPs than there were at the peak, but this is partly explained by a phenomenon that I'll describe when I talk about mergers and acquisitions. The third slide shows the number of employees participating in ownership trusts in the UK. While the number of employees is not expected to grow as dramatically this year as in the past 10 years, the growth has still been terrific. The fourth slide shows the number of EOT transitions in comparison to the number of management buyouts and private equity buyouts in 2024. Even though the chart does not show this, we can assume that the growth rate in the number of EOTs is much higher than the growth rates of the other two types of buyouts shown. These four slides show we're not going backwards in these two countries, but that does not mean we don't have challenges. In fact, I think some of the challenges relate to higher education and employee ownership. Let's assume for the moment that this is correct. And if my assumption is correct, then perhaps the next question should be, have universities sufficiently developed the knowledge infrastructure necessary for the next generation of employee ownership? My short answer is no. And the next stage of higher education involvement with employee ownership requires something more and different than we've done before. It requires moving from asking, how do we create employee ownership, to asking, how do we create exceptionally employee-owned companies from a holistic perspective? This is where university business schools can become incredibly important. I'll talk about a wonderful exception to this rule at Mondragon University in a few minutes. But for the most part, holistic business practices involving employee-owned firms have not been approached by universities. Some will point to the way participative management has been researched and discussed at a number of universities. I appreciate that this work has been substantial and incredibly helpful, but it can't, by its very nature, make up for the fact that employee ownership research and teaching has, for the most part, ignored strategy, operations, mergers and acquisitions, and cost accounting. If all of these topics were being covered in university programs, we'd have a theory of employee ownership management, a theory that is badly needed. Before continuing, let me briefly clarify what I mean by a phrase I used in the title of this talk, that is, quote, purely market-based employee ownership, end quote. I recognize that many people in this room have strong commitments to other forms of employee ownership, including cooperatives. I myself come out of the cooperative movement. And cooperatives have made important contributions around the world, and I respect the traditions attached to the movement. My focus today, though, is narrower. My aim is to advocate for purely market-based employee ownership, ESOPs and EOTs. I contend that models relying on one person, one vote structures, and capped returns on capital are less effective than trust-based models that allow uncapped returns and involve external governance, where outside board members can be more influential. Because traditional cooperatives restrict returns on capital, I exclude them from this definition of, quote, purely market-based employee ownership. To be more particular, the dominant model in the worker cooperative world relies on cashing employees out at book value, which in most of the five countries we've been talking about so far at this symposium is at levels between 1.5 and 3 times lower than fair market value for private companies. By comparison, rather than limiting cash outs in the ESOP and EOT worlds, employees receive their cash outs or profit sharing payments on an unlimited basis, where the constraints are based more on a commitment to stopping abuse, like Peter was talking about earlier, rather than to ideological ties to international cooperative standards. Although some tax advantages or ESOPs disappear, as Peter said, when employees, especially highly compensated employees, receive high benefits. This slide shows what the ratios are for five countries when one is looking at the ratio of fair market value to book value. These statistics compare public companies in each country we've been discussing. These ratios, as well as the estimated values I just gave you for private companies, would disadvantage individual workers who helped create the original value in their companies and then retired if they received book value. This may even be true in Slovenia. But to give Slovenia credit, one of the reasons why the Slovenian model probably works for Slovenia is because the difference between the fair market value and the book value is so small. Then again, these statistics also show why the Slovenian model might not be appropriate for other nations. As always, we want to find models that are culturally and otherwise appropriate as they're shared across the world. So as I now turn to the next question raised in my talk, which is, what can be an employee ownership theory of management? I first say, what that theory is has to begin with this answer. And this question, why do some employee-owned companies become outstanding competitors while others simply become companies with a different ownership structure? The creation of theories of employee ownership management is the best opportunity put before business schools. At the University of Virginia, Darden School of Business, we have, for going on 2 years, been offering executive education classes as part of an initiative called Leading in an Ownership Setting. I should acknowledge that I have a special connection to this program because I'm one of its co-directors. I should also say that the ESOP Association and the Employee Ownership Foundation are the founders of this program and full partners with the Darden School. So one of the goals is to begin developing an employee ownership theory of management. Now, I want to be clear. We're not suggesting that we've discovered a complete theory. And I should say business theories are different from scientific theories. If I drop this pen, gravity gives us a reliable prediction. As you can see, the pen falls, and it will every time. As compared to gravity, business involves people, competition, and changing political environments. But business theories are still valuable because they help us recognize patterns and make better decisions. The theory we're developing brings together several ideas that are usually discussed separately. At universities, too often, strategies people only talk to strategy people. Finance people talk about tax advantages and capital structures. Operations people talk about productivity. Organizational scholars talk about culture and communication. But especially in an employee-owned company, these ideas are connected. Universities need to help make the connections. As the old song goes, the ankle bone's connected to the leg bone, the leg bone's connected to the knee bone. Well, the same is true here. The pieces only work when they connect. Part of the problem, though, is that most employee-owned companies are tactical, not strategic. If you ask about their strategies to their managers, except for the people in this room, you'll hear the managers answer with a very basic notion, such as, We aim to provide our customers or clients with premier service or products at prices that are commensurate with what we deliver. This is not a strategy. This is the next step that a company might take after developing a vision or a mission statement. At Darden, we teach that as one of the first steps in developing an employee ownership theory of management, is that we have to look at disruptive innovation theory. And Clayton Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation explains how companies can challenge established competitors by creating new markets or serving overlooked customers. Employee-owned companies have advantages when pursuing these types of strategies because ownership can encourage patience. Some other employee-owned companies that might be impatient to pay out, for example, high compensation and benefits, might also gain from learning of disruptive innovation because it'll build more long-term thinking. By the way, this impatience to pay more total compensation to employee owners sooner can be combated also by having many more outside board members. Now, as compared to employee-owned firms, conventional companies may reject opportunities because they do not produce immediate financial returns. So employee ownership can lead to more patience can lead to accepting the financial returns in the long term rather than always looking quarter to quarter. The next connection is tax advantages can become strategic advantages. We all know that in countries such as the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom, employee-owned companies and or the sellers to these firms often receive significant tax advantages. The next question is, what should management do with the additional resources that come from tax advantages? Should a company simply distribute the benefits to employee owners, or does it invest? The strongest companies use these advantages to invest in technology, employee ownership development, automation, AI, process improvement, and expansion. Those investments improve productivity. Productivity improves cost position, and cost position creates competitive advantage. This leads to the second connection to an employee ownership theory of management, namely experience curves. One of the oldest lessons in industrial economics is that companies often become more efficient as they gain experience. Ford's Model T is a classic example. Here's a slide that tells the Model T experience curve story. As Ford produced more vehicles, it learned how to improve manufacturing processes. It standardized components. It improved production systems. It reduced cost. Semiconductors provide another example. Here's a slide that shows Moore's law at work. This law says that the number of transistors that can fit on a computer chip tends to double about every 2 years, making computers more powerful over time. Each generation of semiconductor builds upon previous knowledge. Engineering improves, processes improve, costs decline. Here's the experience curve for the semiconductor companies. It tells a similar story as the previous slide, cost decline, when measured on an inflation-adjusted basis in precision-engineered industries. The lesson for employee-owned companies is important. Ownership creates the possibility of retaining knowledge and continuously improving. The fact that research shows that ESOPs in the US and EOTs in the UK have lower rates of employees leaving their companies is important here. When employees have a long-term relationship with the company, the organization has a better opportunity to accumulate experience. Experience creates lower costs, and lower costs create stronger competitive positions. This concludes my discussion of the second leg of describing an employee ownership theory of management, which was use experience curves to your advantage. The third connection to an employee ownership theory of management involves being analytical while growing through strategic acquisitions. Employee-owned companies should not think of ownership as protection from competition. They should think of ownership as a platform for growth and for becoming more competitive. But acquisitions geared toward growth must be strategic. I don't consider conglomerate mergers or holding company mergers to be strategic in the context, given that most employee-owned companies are small to medium size. The challenge with conglomerates is that managing unrelated businesses requires particular capabilities. A company that is excellent at manufacturing refrigerators may not automatically be excellent at software, financial services, or other related industries. Unrelated diversification often decreases the value of a company because management knowledge does not transfer easily across industries. Most research says that conglomerate or holding company mergers only add value 20 to 30% of the time. By contrast, at the Darden School, we focus on teaching that good acquisitions, even ESOPs buying other ESOPs, can strengthen competitive advantage. Now, horizontal acquisitions, that is, quote, like companies buying like companies, can allow employee-owned companies to increase sales, spread fixed costs, improve purchasing power, strengthen market position, and move further down the experience curve. In the same positive direction, vertical acquisitions, which means buying companies in your supply chain, can strengthen supply chains, capture additional margins, improve operational control, and protect strategic capabilities. These types of acquisitions only bring success 50% of the time, but at least 50% is better than the 20 to 30% success rates of holding company acquisitions. The point is that growth should be reinforced by strategy. Employee ownership by itself is not a good substitute for strategy. It's a platform that allows good strategy to compound over time. But then, again, strategy alone is not enough. The fourth theoretical connection we try to make, very particularly, is that the human resources systems used in your companies allow strategy to work. This is the fourth part of our budding employee ownership theory of business. This brings me to what I call the curmudgeon's voice part of the theory. Every organization has skeptics. Some are openly skeptical. Others quietly disagree. These people are often seen as problems. I think that's a mistake. Every organization needs people who ask difficult questions. The problem is not the existence of skeptics or curmudgeons. The problem is when organizations cannot hear them. Employee ownership creates the possibility of broader participation, but ownership does not automatically create openness. Management systems create openness. Many companies use employee surveys, but employees often wonder whether their answers are truly confidential. If people do not trust the process, they will not provide honest information. And if leaders do not hear honest information, they can't make good decisions. So employee-owned companies need management practices that create psychological safety, transparent decision-making, honest conversations, and real follow-through. The goal for managers is not to, quote, tell it like it is. The goal is to improve decisions, relationships, and performance. When employee owners understand the strategy, when they understand why decisions are made, and when leaders genuinely listen, the strategic pieces begin to connect. And please excuse my artwork on this next slide. Innovation connects to investment. Investment connects to productivity. Productivity connects to cost position. Cost position connects to growth. Growth can come from good acquisitions. The ankle bone is connected to the leg bone. My connection is that universities have an important role to play in building strategic and theoretical knowledge. Several institutions have already contributed significantly. Rutgers University, which has been mentioned, has played an important role in developing rigorous research on employee ownership, including on ESOP performance, employee ownership outcomes, wealth creation, and governance. Rutgers has also helped create, both within and outside government, some of the most robust data sets available. This is incredibly important, and every nation establishing employee ownership should help create and have these data sets to help track important statistics. But as the field matures, we need continued methodological precision. Researchers must be clear about what ownership model they're studying. An ESOP is not the same as a cooperative. A stock option plan is not the same as an ESOP. And comparisons must carefully consider differences such as tax advantages and whether certain research can be accurate if it compares a tax-advantaged ESOP to a non-employee-owned company with no tax advantage. These distinctions matter because employee ownership needs research that can stand up confidently within mainstream business scholarship. The University of Oxford has also contributed internationally through research, publications, award programs, and conferences. Several other universities that have more than one person working on employee ownership have made in contributions, important contributions to the field as well, including Harvard Business School, Kent State University in the US, University of Leeds, Queen's University in Canada, University of California, San Diego, and Salisbury University in the US. Although today's focus is primarily on ESOPs and EOT, no discussion of universities and employee ownership would be complete without examining Mondragon. Mondragon is unusual because it's not simply a cooperative network that has a university that studies employee ownership. The university is part of an integrated ecosystem that combines education, cooperative enterprise, innovation, and regional economic development. Its origins are especially instructive. In the 1940s, a young Catholic priest arrived in the Basque town of Mondragon in Spain. He wanted to work on cooperative economic development. Rather than beginning with a cooperative business, he began with education. He believed that rebuilding the local economy after the Spanish Civil War required creating skilled, ethically grounded young people. The technical school he founded eventually became Mondragon University. That educational effort produced the engineers, managers, entrepreneurs, and cooperative leaders who later created what became the Mondragon Network of Worker-Owned Enterprises. Education came first, cooperative enterprise followed. Together, they produced one of the world's most important examples of employee ownership serving as an engine for regional economic development. While few regions are likely to replicate the Mondragon model in its entirety, it reminds us that universities can do far more than educate students or complete research. They can become catalysts for creating an ownership culture that transforms an entire regional economy. But we must also be aware of the mistakes Mondragon has made in its education and in its broader management practices, as compared to promoting a horizontal or vertical mergers and acquisition strategy, Mondragon taught and practices a conglomerate model. Mondragon developed a company that put a white goods manufacturing company, that is, a firm that manufactured refrigerators, together with a software company, and at its peak, 108 other cooperative businesses. Now, there may be a few people at leveraged buyout firms that know how to manage both refrigerator companies and software companies, but outside of leveraged buyout firms, almost no one knows how to do this. And because the companies were linked in the same way that American ESOP holding companies are, when the refrigerator company filed for bankruptcy, it almost took down the whole of Mondragon. Luckily, rather than bail out the white goods company indefinitely, the Mondragon Federation eventually allowed it to fail. It would have been better if Mondragon had been more focused from the very beginning, rather than being a holding company of such diverse industries. But I don't want to be too negative. Mondragon is an absolutely fabulous place. So I think I've established that a university can help create the people, knowledge, and culture that allow employee owners to succeed. This brings me to the University of Learning, my last topic. This is soon to be a real live university. The University of Learning begins with a simple idea. Those who create knowledge, teach students, and build the institution should have a meaningful ownership role in the institution itself. The challenge facing higher education today is not simply financial. It's structural. Many people question whether universities remain focused primarily on learning. The model at the University of Learning is based on faculty and employee ownership, professional governance, academic independence, and long-term stewardship. The university itself, a nonprofit, would have an employee ownership trust component as it focuses on teaching, degrees, research, and academic excellence. Please talk with Graham or with me if you'd like to learn how a nonprofit can utilize EOT attributes. A related employee-owned enterprise at the University of Learning creates opportunities at the university for technology transfer, executive education, digital learning, and entrepreneurship. The project is now moving from concept toward reality. Ram Sharma, currently president and chancellor of UPS in northern India, has put the initiative into motion. UPS is a leading Indian university, particularly strong in business and engineering. Ram will leave that university to start our new university. With support from senior educational officials and members of the Indian Administrative Services, we're exploring the creation of the university in Uttarakhand near the foothills of the Himalayas. The trust formation process is expected to begin in 2026. The proposed board includes leaders with experience in higher education, government, accreditation, and business. I've been asked to be an official senior advisor to the university. The goal is to build an institution serving approximately 4,000 students within 6 years. Any surplus would support these three purposes, and here are the third of them. First, scholarship and research. Second, employee owner profit sharing. And third, the part I really want you to hear is we are willing to put money into the creation of additional employee-owned universities internationally. The ambition is not simply to create one institution. The ambition is to demonstrate a model and then replicate that model, a model where ownership, learning, innovation, and economic development reinforce one another. Between now and Thursday afternoon, when we'll have a breakout session on the Indian Employee-Owned University, I hope you'll talk with one another and with me about this. On Thursday, we'll speak about how your ideas about the employee-owned university can be integrated, and we'll also discuss how one-third of the surplus money can be spent on new universities that you, Ram Sharma, and I can build. Smita Mankind, by the way, who many of you remember from this symposium, is also deeply involved. So let me return to the question I began with. What role should universities play in the next stage of employee ownership? My answer is, universities must help create the knowledge infrastructure for the next generation. The first generation of employee ownership proved that employees can become owners. The next generation must prove that employee-owned companies can become some of the best companies in the world. And that will require better research, better management theory, better education, and better strategy. And most important, a better understanding of how ownership changes the way organizations compete. The future of employee ownership will not be created only through legislation and transactions. Those created the foundation. The next stage will be created through ideas, through evidence, through leadership, and through institutions that help us understand how employee ownership can become not just a fairer model of ownership, but a stronger model of enterprise. Thank you. So I have prepared two people to make some comments here, and then I'll take questions and comments. So where is Ethan? Ethan, I wanted to ask you a question. What do you think of this idea of the theory of employee ownership management?
Well, I think it's great. I'm Ethan Ron, professor at Harvard Business School and co-chair of the Ownership Project. I think that without theory, education won't change. And to give you a corollary, 1976, William Meckling and Michael Jensen wrote a paper called Theory of the Firm. The subtitle of that paper was Managerial Behavior, Agency Costs, and Ownership Structure. That has shaped the entire way we do research and teach for the next 50 years. And basically what it laid the seeds for was shareholder primacy. So they explained how shareholder primacy should be the focus of corporations. We as researchers then did research to test their theory. And then we built curriculums around that theory, which then educated leaders to go out and think that the way to run a firm is through shareholder primacy, maximizing profits for shareholders. And so I think without a similar theory on employee ownership or employee-owned firms, it's going to be challenging to motivate educators as well as to develop a concise and coherent curriculum around employee ownership and how we manage an employee-owned firm.
Thank you. I want to call on Sam now, and Sam will introduce himself and tell us what perhaps a corporation could do to help efforts like these.
Thanks, John. I'm Sam. I'm from Scott Barda. It's a UK-based employee-owned company, but we're all over the world. Part of our purpose is to grow employee ownership, and we have manufacturing in India. So hearing about the University of Learning is extremely exciting for us, not just because it's another employee-owned business. That's great, but so what? If it's a university that can be a real incubator for other employee-owned businesses and a place where research can happen, maybe that's the best type of employee ownership business that you can have out there. So as corporations, we feel like we have a moral duty to support employee ownership, and I know other models also feel that as well. So if there's, well, we're looking at ways that we might be able to contribute financially to support this.
We appreciate that.
Comments, questions from the audience? If there are none, we can move on. But as you can tell, this is an important topic to me. What do you think? Should there be a theory of employee ownership management?
Yeah.
Campbell, why?
So I guess I would say that this really aligns with something I've been trying to push the community in the UK to think about for a while, right? Which is, what would an ISO for employee ownership management look like?
Tell us what an ISO is.
So it's an international management standard, right? So they're pretty ubiquitous. So certainly in kind of UK, if you want to win public sector contracts and things like that, people will really look for this. It's kind of ISO 9001 is kind of basic management standards. 14001 gives you kind of sustainability standards and so on. I see lots of people nodding, right? So I'm kind of like, look, we've got 12 years of trust-based management practice in the UK. There's, when you look at it and you dig into it, there's quite a lot of connectivity between the various activities that are going on. It we're not that far away, in my view, from constructing what would be the basic sections of an ISO. And to me, that's just a different name for a theory of effective management within a certain business structure. So, yeah, I think it's a fantastic argument, fantastic idea.
Other people, are you scared by the concept of, well, go ahead and talk first, Maureen.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to, I guess I kind of want to ask Ethan this question, because I think there is this very sort of simple theory of the firm with the principal agent theory and everything. And I think there's fairly, you can, you know, and I think I've said this to you before, you can basically apply that same theory and just say you're extending principal agent theory throughout the firm by building employee ownership. But I think that part of the challenge is that that's not necessarily in the interest of people who are the owners right now. And so is it really that we don't have a theory, or is it really that we sort of have entrenchment in terms of power that is kind of creating the friction?
Damn, somebody else read Jensen and Meckling here, and I'm in over my head. I think it's a combination of both, actually. Depending on your view of shareholder primacy, it's either like one of the great benefits or one of the most pernicious aspects of that argument is that it's a cut and paste that can apply to public companies, which were the dominant form at the time, but also fits into, like, it's a familiar form for most private structures as well. And going back to John's comment, you know, EOT is not an ESOP, is not a co-op. And so can you apply, like, can you create a theory, a one-size-fits-all theory for employee ownership? I think that, A, you do need a new theory here. I don't think the Jensen and Meckling shareholder primacy agency cost model fits perfectly into employee ownership, because the objective, you know, for an ESOP is as much maximizing profits as it is the sustainability of the ESOP, the liquidity of the funds. And so, yeah, so I do think that you need, I'm confident that a new theory would be beneficial. I don't want to be prescriptive. But I think the big challenge will come in, can we achieve that Jensen and Meckling goal of creating a theory that can be applied broadly to what we mean by employee ownership?
So I have a very bad habit of always calling on someone other than myself to have the final word when I teach. And I give people an opportunity to actually stand and take the microphone and just say how they feel about what they've just heard. So can I get a volunteer? You get 2 minutes and then we'll go to the next panel or less.
It's taken me 15 years to come to the meeting, John. Mm-hmm. I thought I could give 2 minutes back.
Thank you, Carol.
So I have two observations. I was in business school when Jensen and Meckling was required reading. So I can attest to what it meant. I think there are two reasons why the theory is important and why the theory is timely. If you were to ask someone who's in business school today and compare it to 30 years ago, there are two key changes in business schools in America, to my experience. The first is the rise of an interest in social interest, whether it's called social impact or social entrepreneurship. And the second is the rise in the effective use of technology in business. And I think this discussion and the way that you've presented it is completely consistent with the evolution of business thinking in America. So if that can be extrapolated around the world, well done. But I think it's really powerful, John. Thank you.